New Year, everyone, and welcome to the first MJA podcast for 2020. I'm your host, Kate Swanell, and I'm looking forward to a year of cracking topics to brighten up your commute. First cap off the rank today is the topic of frailty, and specifically the differences between frailty in men and in women. My special guest is Dr. Emily Gordon, a consultant geriatrician at the Princess Alexandra Hospital in Brisbane and a researcher at the University of Queensland's Centre for Health Services Research. Emily and her colleague, Professor Ruth Hubbard, looked at the evidence base for interventions for frailty. Welcome, Emily, and I'm going to start off with a pretty basic question. What is frailty? How do we define it?
Frailty is something that many of us feel is very easy to see, but somewhat difficult to define. It often doctors will describe it as being this end of the bed gut feeling about somebody in front of them. But over time, as it's become, as our population is aging, and we're becoming more and more interested in our aging population, we're trying to figure out, well, how can we actually measure this? How can we actually define it? And so now in the literature, the most widely shared definition of frailty, the best that we can do at the moment, is that it's this state of increased vulnerability. So these are individuals who are, compared with other people of the same age, are more likely to experience adverse health outcomes, whether that be passing away, but also things such as delirium, urinary incontinence, falls, pressure injuries.
And how do we measure it these days?
Well, the end of the bedogram, as we call it, in many cases can be accurate, particularly if you've got a long history of experience, you've worked with a lot of elderly people, but that's not good enough, to be honest.
No.
And so there's been quite a big research effort that's gone into trying to figure out how we can go about defining it and measuring it. Mm. And there's probably two main models or constructs that we use. And one is what we call the phenotypic model or the phenotype model. And this is where it's frailty is defined as the presence of signs or symptoms. And the most widely known phenotypic model is the Freed frailty phenotypic model.
Mm-hmm.
And this looks at weight loss, it looks at weakness, slowness, fatigue, and low physical activity. So if we think about those criteria, that's exactly what we see at the end of the bed. But another model tries to define frailty in a more detailed way, in a more granular way, and this is the frailty index. And the idea of the frailty index, which represents what's called the accumulated deficit model of frailty, is that the more problems an individual has, the more likely they are to be frail.
Right.
And again, that makes sense with the type of people that we see in hospital.
Mm.
But the frailty index gives us a number that on a scale of 0 to 1 to define how frail an individual might be.
Do all elderly people become frail?
Yes. Overall, if an individual, as they age, is in general, we would say would become frail.
Mm-hmm.
But people become frail at different stages of their lives. So there are many, many people that go right into old age who are very, very fit, and others who become frail even in middle age or at a young old age. But I think you would say that if you're a centenarian, centenarians will be frail.
It's a bit like dementia in that if you live long enough, you're going to get it.
Dementia, slightly different
yes,
in terms of the pathophysiology, but I think if you're living into your hundreds, you're going to be ticking the boxes as a frail older person.
Is there a specific mechanism that causes it, or is it just a natural part of ageing? Is it just wear and tear?
At the moment, the exact pathophysiology of frailty is unclear, but there's a number of theories about frailty, and probably the strongest is that it's related to inflammation or chronic inflammation.
Oh, okay.
So it's possible that there's some overlapping pathways between, you know, in inverted commas, healthy aging versus frailty, but why one goes down one pathway as opposed to the other is still a little bit unclear.
Yeah.
But in terms of the chronic inflammation, there's lots of theories about what causes that, but the exact etiology isn't known.
Is it preventable?
Well, at the moment, we don't know. There's very limited data looking at the prevention of the onset of frailty. There's a lot of theory, you know.
Yep.
In theory, if we could prevent the onset of inflammation or reduce the inflammation or reduce the other pathophysiological pathways, perhaps we can prevent frailty, but we don't have any good evidence for that at the moment.
Your narrative review was looking specifically at the difference between frailty in men and frailty in women. What are the differences, and are they a mystery to us?
What we what we know so far is that the prevalence of frailty and also the degree of frailty or the severity of frailty is higher in females than men, mm-hmm. males of the same age.
Okay.
And this has been found time and time again in community dwellers across the world. But probably the key issue is even though that females may be more frail, what we do find, though, is that they're less likely to die of the same frailty and the same age. So this then becomes what we call a sex frailty paradox.
They're sicker, but they're more resilient.
That's right. Or to be even more crude, females seem to get sick and males die.
Yeah, interesting. I'm chatting today with Emily Gordon, a geriatrician and researcher from the University of Queensland. Her co-authored narrative review on frailty is available at mja.com.au. This is our first pod for 2020, so I'm going to remind you that you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes, or you can listen by going to mja.com.au/podcasts and pressing play. Our podcasts are open access, and you don't have to be an MJA subscriber or an AMA member to listen. Back to our chat. When somebody becomes frail, are there things we can do to make their lives easier or to make the progression of it slower?
In terms of the evidence that we have, as you would see in this narrative review, this is a relatively unclear area.
Mm.
There's been quite a number of studies looking particularly at frail individuals and trying to see whether they can make them less frail or perhaps prevent the progression of their frailty.
Yep.
And the level of evidence or the quality of evidence is still quite poor. Probably the best evidence we have is for exercise and nutrition. So if we do have a frail individual trying to improve their level of physical activity and their strength and their mobility,
mm-hmm.
and also trying to optimise their nutrition, at this stage these seem to be the most useful interventions for this population. Of course, though, like frailty is multi-dimensional.
Yep.
These individuals are often in very complex psychosocial circumstances as well. And whilst the evidence may not be strong as such, our practical mind or pragmatically, we think, also trying to improve those other dimensions of their health, their social circumstances, social support, their psychological well-being also seem to make sense. Some of our frailest patients are those with dementia.
Yeah.
And interestingly, though, those with dementia on the surface of things may not look frail in that they might be quite physically robust.
Ah.
You know, they're on their feet, they're getting around.
Yeah.
But when we look at all the other problems, so because of their dementia, they can't manage their activities of daily living. By
yes.
definition, they are also frail and therefore also vulnerable to delirium, to
okay.
And other adverse hospital, adverse health outcomes.
Exercise and nutrition, do those things work differently for men and women?
Again, this hasn't been specifically addressed in the literature, but if we'll look at the particular studies that have been done, we can start to think that maybe they work differently for men and women.
Mm.
So, for example, compared with men, women tend to have higher rates of sarcopenia, which is poor muscle quality and,
yep.
and weakness.
Yep.
They often, you know, have higher rates of osteoporosis, higher rates of falls.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps the type of exercise that may be beneficial to women would be beneficial to men. Perhaps females will benefit more from strength training and balance training, and men might benefit more from cardiovascular aerobic activity. But these
okay.
are questions that we don't quite know. Similarly
yeah.
with nutrition, we know that men tend to have a poorer understanding of nutrition, make poorer nutritional decisions,
mm-hmm.
choices than females. And again, the types of studies that have been done, there is a hint, a suggestion that nutritional interventions may be more helpful again for men than for women.
Clearly, we need some more research on this group of people.
Yeah, I think when providing care for older people is about trying to tailor your care, providing patient-centred care, then a fundamental difference between our patients is whether they're males or females.
Mm-hmm.
And if we think that they differ in terms of how they age and what they're vulnerable to, then it makes sense that we need to start thinking more carefully about what treatments or interventions they may benefit from. But as I've said, there's very little data to support this. It's hypothetically, you know, in theory it makes a lot of sense,
mm-hmm.
But we don't have the evidence that we need to go ahead and justify very careful sex-specified interventions. Most of the evidence that we have, as little as there is coming from community dwellers.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no doubt that we need more information about how to best support the frail elderly living in nursing homes.
Is there a point at which trying to intervene with somebody who is frail, is there a point at which that falls into the question of futility of care?
I guess it all depends on what intervention we're talking about.
Yeah.
Intervening in a very invasive way going to actually cause more adverse outcomes, you know, where the risk is actually higher than the benefit, is a very important care consideration. And certainly when we're making decisions about intervening, we really have to have a good understanding of an individual's frailty, because to provide them with the most information about what their risks are, we need to think about how frail they are. So sometimes, yes, certainly if you have an extremely frail individual who is lining up for a very invasive treatment, such as a surgery, the risks of that surgery may in fact outweigh the benefit, and you're better off not intervening. But if you have a non-invasive treatment, you know, such as an exercise or a nutrition, I think you could argue that even the most frailest may benefit from that, some interventions. Yep. If we're going to provide patient-centred care, I think as physicians or as doctors, we need to keep in mind that we are dealing with males and females who differ in fundamental ways, and that that's going to have implications for the way we care for those older people.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kate.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.